This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 84 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frühling. Today, we're going to be doing another edition of our Essentials, our Philosophy Essential podcast. Today, we're going to be discussing The Next Generation Season 5. Zachary, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Mike. It's great to be in a routine. We got a nice comment on Twitter. One of our listeners pointed out that we had two episodes of Metatrex in as many weeks, so it's great to be back in a routine together.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I've missed that as well. Any time that we can talk about Star Trek and philosophy, I mean, that's a good time is had by all. So it's. I agree. It's great to be back into a routine.
Oh, and we are getting right into my wheelhouse today with TNG Season 5. The middle seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation are really what turned me into a serious Trek fan as opposed to a casual Trek fan. So we are firmly in my wheelhouse here talking about TNG Season 5.
Well, I'm excited to dive in, but before we talk about our initial thoughts on this season, let me just say, for those of you who are listening, every four episodes of Metatrex, Zachary and I break down a season of Star Trek, and we mine from it the absolute essentials. This in no way is an in-depth dive into a single episode or a single philosophical topic, but rather we sort of do a high-level flyover of an entire season of Star Trek, and we just mine out for all of you what we consider, at least at that point in time, the essential philosophy from that season. So typically we're talking 3, 4, 5 picks a piece. We'll talk about them briefly. We are working in reverse order for those of you keeping score. So when we started this, we actually started with Enterprise Season 4, and we've gone backwards from because everybody goes forward. That's kind of boring. We wanted to go backwards. So we've gone backwards now, and here we are in the fifth season of Star Trek The Next Generation. I just want to say, this is a tough season to just pull a few episodes from, in my humble opinion. This season is so full of just really rich philosophical Star Trek. It's mind-blowing. I found it very difficult to just say, you know, okay, here are my three picks, and I have three honorable mentions, but, I mean, you could almost, like, just put the episodes on a wall and throw darts at them, and that's a great one, and throw another dart, and that's a great one. Doesn't matter where they hit, they're all great. They're all excellent, excellent. This is just, for me, is where Star Trek The Next Generation really shines philosophically.
This is one of the best seasons of Star Trek in general, across all series, across all seasons.
You always say that.
Maybe I mean it every time. But I had a slightly different experience than you. I took a pretty serious razor to this season. I had a pretty short list at the end of the day. There are a lot of episodes that I happened to really like, or that happened to touch on a particular topic but didn't have a lot to offer on that topic. So I had a pretty short list, honestly, as much as I love TNG Season 5.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. This is such a strong season of Star Trek, but I wasn't maybe as choosy. And I have to say, I'm just going to kind of tip my hand just a little bit before I throw it at you for the first pick. I just have to say that going through these, we really are looking for essentials. And I think our listeners are going to find that these episodes of Star Trek, at least on my list from The Next Generation Season 5, are episodes that we've covered extensively here on Metatrek. So our back catalog, if you go back, and I'll try to mention from time to time, but if you go back in our back catalog, it's not difficult to find many, many episodes from Season 5 of The Next Generation and our back catalog where we have gone into a deep dive and talked about extensively, either from the topical point of view or from the episodic point of view.
I should give a little caveat as well that my picks today, as always when we do an Essential Trek Philosophy episode, are just what I happen to find particularly interesting or particularly essential at this moment in time. If you'd asked me 5 years ago or 10 years ago which episodes from this season I found most philosophically interesting, I might have given different answers. If you ask me in a year, I might even give different answers than I give today. So this isn't the final word on philosophy in Star Trek TNG Season 5. It's just what I happen to find particularly essential and particularly interesting today.
And with that, Zachary, what is your first pick, sir?
So I have The Masterpiece Society. Was that on your list?
It is actually one of my honorable mentions, yes.
You know, it's funny. This episode is an episode that I didn't used to care for. I used to find it incredibly boring. It's an incredibly slow episode. If you remember, it's the episode where there is a colony of humans that are genetically engineered, where each individual serves a certain role, a certain function. They know from birth what they're going to be, and they naturally kind of fall into their destiny because that's what they're genetically programmed to be. And their society is a very carefully constructed society with each person serving a certain function. And for me, it raises quite a few questions. One question that it raises to me is the question of free will versus determinism. Mm-hmm. Is our ideal life, our interests and our passions and the things that make us who we are, the best version of ourselves, really predetermined genetically, either in the genetic engineering sense, which is what happens in this episode, people are genetically bred or genetically engineered to serve this certain function, or just through random evolution and random natural selection and whatever genetic makeup we end up with, does that determine who we are? So it has this free will versus determinism element, but that's not what I find particularly interesting about this episode. The most interesting topic to me in this episode is this question of transhumanism. Can we build a better human where we take all of the ambiguity of human life and all of the uncertainty and all of the pain and strife that goes along with the human condition and build a variety of humans that don't have those qualities? Ostensibly, if you look at the society in this episode, they're a very happy society. Everyone has their function. Everyone is doing exactly what they want to do because that's what they were genetically engineered to do. There's no war. There's no strife. It's an idyllic kind of society. And Captain Picard rightly points out that He worries they've bred away the things that make life worth living, the uncertainty and the self-discovery and, you know, having to choose A versus choosing B and the hard choices in life. And it just raises this question of whether we should even try to become better versions of humans in this transhumanism sense, or whether we should embrace that human condition as an essential part of who we are.
As I mentioned, this is an honorable mention on my list. And like you, it's never really been one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek. Now, that being said, my interest in this is the story that it tells and the questions that it raises. It you're absolutely right. It asks some really interesting questions. You mentioned free will versus determinism, but I think it even goes a little bit beyond that, where, you know, as you mentioned, you know, we're talking about, can we create the ideal human being? And we've been trying to answer that question, frankly, for thousands of years. And, you know, in the 20th century, we probably had one of the best examples of a society actively pursuing that goal in Nazi Germany. They were trying to create the perfect German, the Übermensch. So we have that example, you know, from, I would consider it to be, you know, recent human history. And in many ways, this society kind of reflects that, in that, not in a malicious sense or in any way that is evil, but, you know, rather for the betterment of their own culture, their own society, they're trying to create this perfect human. And it's actually a catastrophe, a emergency that has brought the Enterprise there, and their presence has stirred this community to ask a lot of questions, to reflect upon what they're doing, and ask themselves, is there more out there? Is there more than, you know, just this kind of provincial life that we're living in? And, you know, can I transcend even what I've been genetically created to be? And so for the story's sake, and for the sake of, I think, these great questions that it's asking, I had to throw this on my list. But it's a slow episode, but it's an episode, I think, that's really rich topically if you're really watching Star Trek, you know, as a thinking person show. This has got to go on your list.
I think what I've come to appreciate about this episode over the years is that it breaks the trope of how Star Trek usually deals with eugenics and genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, Star Trek is very critical of genetic engineering and eugenics. You end up with Khan in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, or you end up with Kodos the Executioner, mm-hmm, in The Conscience of a King that we talked about last time on Metatrex. But here we see a fairly benign depiction of a genetically engineered society. You don't have a dictator. You don't have war. You don't have totalitarianism. You don't have Nazis. You don't have anything like that. It's a very idyllic society. You can still ask the question of whether that society is worth living in, as Captain Picard rightly does. But it paints genetic engineering in a pretty favorable light, I would say. The most dramatic thing that happens in the episode is a little tremor in the middle of a kid's piano recital. But what I like about that is it forces you to ask this hard question. Rather than choosing between really bad versions of genetic engineering like Khan and the type of life we see in the Federation, we get to choose here between a really benign, pleasant, idyllic society that's genetically engineered and another pretty idyllic life, the life that we see in Starfleet and in the Federation. And for me, it's a question of whether that free will element is an important part of life. I think you could point to the 20th century existentialist philosophers like Jean-Paul Sartre, who would say that this radical freedom of choice to define ourselves and choose what our lives are going to be, no matter what constraints, no matter what other influences there are, you can't escape that burden of choice. I think it's interesting in two senses. One is the question of whether that's true. Is that an important part of the human condition? Is that something we want to retain at all costs, that radical freedom to define ourselves? And second, has this society that we see in the Masterpiece Society actually succeeded in achieving a society that has bred that out? It sure seems like there's not a lot of free choice inside that society. I don't know if there's still choice about who they marry and who they have children with. And they certainly don't have much of a choice in terms of what their career path is going to be, what their interests are, what defines them as people. I just wonder to what extent the free will element has been completely bred out of their society.
And that's the genius in the writing of this episode. There was a line, and I think the character's name was Hannah, who said, "All of us in this colony have been living in the Dark Ages. It's like we were victims of a 200-year-old joke. Until you came, all we could see was the wall of our biosphere. Suddenly, our eyes have been opened to the infinite possibilities." And so you see this kind of idyllic culture, but then we ask a question like that. We kind of paint it in a way that we see the hunger of Hannah and certainly some of the other members of this society who are saying, wait a second, there's something more than what we have inside this bubble. There's something more than the bubble. There's something outside the bubble. And we can make our own choices and live our own lives and marry who we want to marry. And, you know, so those questions get raised inside the episode. And it makes it really interesting because it's not in any way, I think, expressing an opinion, but rather giving you two points of view to the same problem and letting you decide.
Before we move on to your first pick, Mike, I want to ask you a question about this episode. So at the end of the episode, some of the colonists leave to go with the Enterprise. If it's really true that they're genetically bred to serve a certain function and to have certain interests and to find certain things fulfilling, doesn't that kind of ipso facto presume that they are choosing the path of unhappiness and they will be less happy than they would be if they stayed?
Yes, I don't think there's really an answer to that because, you know, you have to first define happiness. And frankly, Zachary, I think your definition of happiness and perhaps my definition of happiness would be two different things. And if we were to do a straw poll of our listeners, I think we would all get, everyone would answer that probably in one of many different ways.
To me, it points out a potential conflict in our values. On the one hand, we do prioritize happiness, especially in our American democratic society, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? But you could argue that this episode makes the claim that existential awareness, the anxiety of free will, is to be prioritized over happiness, that a happy life that's not free is still not worth living.
I think that argument can definitely be made inside the episode. But again, Hannah goes on to say that, at least imply that they had moved from a place of innocence, and because of the presence of the Enterprise and everything that the Federation represents, that innocence has been taken away from them.
Yeah, and I think the people that choose to leave, they've become aware and they've made this existential choice that their free will matters more than their quote-unquote happiness inside the Masterpiece Society. The people that choose to stay have made a different choice. And it's interesting because it almost amounts to a prisoner who loves his or her chains. They choose to stay inside the box, sure, inside the bubble, and they just choose to be happy. And maybe they're not as bothered by that existential issue, but they're at least aware of it. They have this heightened awareness of the situation that they're in because of the Enterprise's arrival. But does that mean that their choice to stay is a fully fledged, fully free choice? Or is it tantamount to a prisoner loving chains?
Yeah, that's...
I don't know the answer to that.
There's no easy answer. Yeah, there's certainly no easy answer. And, you know, for that matter, will they truly be happy in the future because of, you know, this incursion?
Everyone has to work two jobs now.
Yeah. You know, it's
half their society's gone.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Wish Hannah were still here to maintain this biosphere, darn
it. Doggone it. Well, we'll just have to...
Used to have weekends free. Now I have to do Hannah's job.
That's a great pick, and it's on my honorable mentions list for sure.
So it was surprising to me that this episode was top of my list in the entire season. Like I said before, this episode, I didn't used to find it very interesting. I found it, frankly, kind of boring and slow. But over the years, I've found it kind of charming in a couple of ways. One is just the idyllic nature of the society I find very charming. There is this charming love story with Troy and Aaron, the leader of the Masterpiece Society. But it raises these issues. I think as I get older, I just find myself more and more intrigued by these questions of free will and what matters in life and what you want to achieve and the struggle of figuring that out and how to balance where you're at now with where you want to be. Those issues didn't bother me 10 years ago like they do now as I get a little older. And it's funny that this episode has become more and more relevant to me over the years. And it's incredibly interesting that it was top of my list out of this entire season.
So it's literally the top of your list.
It was the top of my list for the season, yes.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, for me, it's predominantly the whole idea of this idyllic society. Can you create, one way or another, can you create an idyllic society? And at the end of the day, the messiness of the Federation is more appealing, certainly to some of these people. Than this idyllic society that they're living in. It's become mundane and uninteresting and less appealing than the question marks of what's outside that biosphere.
And Starfleet in particular is a pretty structured society. You have your function on the ship. It's very similar to what goes on inside this episode, except that Starfleet officers choose to go to the academy and they choose what track they're going to be on. And there's this kind of free will element to choosing to be in Starfleet and on whatever track you're on that people right. in the Masterpiece Society don't have to choose, right? They don't get that moment of choice even earlier in life.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a great one. So Zachary, my first pick is Darmok. I can't imagine an essentials list without Darmok, primarily because it is, and I have to say this because I'm an author and I have this appreciation in literature, and certainly it's a big part of my writing style. It really deals with the philosophy of language, certainly this idea of metaphor and the way we tell our stories that I find so appealing. And this is one of those episodes of Star Trek that I can sit down and just watch over and over again. It doesn't get old for me. It's one of those episodes that I can just watch one off. If I'm going for a random episode of Star Trek, I'm going to probably Darmok, simply because it deals very directly with that idea of metaphor and the way we tell our stories, the philosophy of language, that I just find so appealing and so fascinating. As all of our listeners know, a lot of the dialogue in it is seemingly gibberish, but they're telling a much larger story. They are really, in a lot of ways, asking some questions that I think are important in the way in that we oftentimes will express ourselves in metaphor and how important that is and how important our stories are to bringing us together and giving us the comprehension to see one another as equals and to form relationships, to conquer tasks. Even in the corporate world, we try to do this with team building exercises. We try to teach our teams to communicate and to work together. And that's really what's going on inside this episode. It's all about learning to communicate and find common ground and face difficulties together and work things out together. And I just find it very appealing. It's, again, one of those episodes I go back to time and time again. It never gets old for me.
I run the risk of being strung up and put out to dry in saying this, but Darmok has never been one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek to watch again and again. I actually find it a little tedious because of those things. Yes, it's interesting. I understand why it's brilliant. I even like it, but I don't go back to it. It's not one of my favorites in this season at all. But that said, it is on my list of essential Trek philosophy from this season. That said, it is one of my picks for essential Trek philosophy from season 5 of The Next Generation. But for a slightly different reason than the reason you described. You had mentioned philosophy of language, and that happens to be one of my interests in philosophy. And this episode reminds me very much of the philosopher Wittgenstein. And Wittgenstein, in his later works, was very critical of his earlier work about philosophy of language and the concept of referential language. In Wittgenstein's early work, he tried to give an analysis of language in terms of reference. So take a term like water. If you ask what the meaningfulness of water is, you would just say, well, water refers to something. It points to an object in the world, water, actual mm-hmm. water somewhere, right? And that's what water means, a very simplistic sort of one-to-one correspondence between word and object, and he tried to put together this calculus of language as it refers to the world, hoping that in analyzing language, you can learn things kind of metaphysically about the world. In his later work, he rejected all of that. He started to reflect on the actual meaningfulness of language and really started to concentrate on non-referential language, things like metaphor. Like, we used the example of water a minute ago. Suppose someone just shouted, water! That could mean 50 different things. It could mean I'm thirsty. Sure. It could mean there's a flood coming. It could mean whatever, right? It doesn't just mean water in a very narrow sense, in the sense of referring to some actual instance of water in the world. It could be a question like, are you thirsty? Water?
Right.
And what I love about Darmok is it's an episode based almost entirely on non-referential language. The stories and the sentences that we get inside Darmok could refer to actual historical events in this culture's history. We don't actually know. We're not really treated to that information, whether they refer to literal stories or whether they refer to mythology or fictional stories. Let's assume it's the latter. If they refer purely to fictional stories, then it's pretty clear that the language inside Darmok, the vast majority of it, doesn't actually refer to anything. And yet it's still so clearly meaningful, and it allows Captain Picard and this alien captain to communicate and work together and build a bond. It's a clear example of meaningful language that doesn't necessarily have to refer to anything literal at all.
Some of the non-gibberish dialogue within this episode, I think really, in a lot of ways, paints the picture for us. For instance, Troy says within the episode that imagery is everything to this alien culture, the Temerians. She says it embodies their emotional states, their very thought processes. It's how they communicate and it's how they think. That to me is really fascinating. This idea of thinking in metaphor. And it amazes me when I have conversations with people and we cite things like movie references. We speak movie to one another. Sports fans might, you know.
Oh, Star Trek fans never do this.
We never do this. So it amazes me because certainly we don't necessarily think in metaphors, but we do communicate in metaphors. For instance, within the episode,
Captain Picard at Panthera 4,
Temba, his arms wide. That's a metaphor for giving and receiving. It's very analogous to that idea within their minds. And it's not just something that they're saying, but it's literally, it's how they think. They don't just speak this metaphor, but they think in terms of those metaphor. And to me, that's incredible. That's really interesting. This idea of not just speaking and communicating and trying to convey an idea, but literally this is how I'm processing the information that I receive. I'm literally thinking in metaphor. I find that very fascinating.
I feel like our situation then in the later part of the 20th century and now in the early part of the 21st century is interesting in this regard, because I almost feel like our ability to communicate in this way was damaged by the overly logical, overly propositional, overly analytical language of the 20th century. It's almost like we've lost the ability to think and speak and reason and communicate and move each other through metaphors. And you've been a salesperson, I've been a salesperson, and we both mm-hmm. know that people fundamentally are moved by their emotions more than they're moved by logic. And what better way to stir someone's emotions than with a good story? In fact, we do this as Star Trek fans all the time. We're also moved by Star Trek, and it's all because of what it stirs inside of us, not necessarily because of the logical reaction inside of us. So as I kind of look at the broad brushstroke cultural progression of us in relation to language, you know, coming out of like 19th century romanticism, flowery language and poetic metaphors is what I think of when I think of that time period. Even when we're talking mm-hmm. about serious things, I think the language was more ornate in that way, more metaphorical in that way. And then in the early part of the 20th century, that philosophically, our concept of language got narrowed. We focused on scientific language. We focused on logic. We focused on a reference. And sure, there are always poets and there are always musicians and there are always creative people in any time period. But culturally, I think that's not what people found interesting about language. And I think in the latter part of the 20th century, and now in the early part of the 21st century, that situation has changed. I think we've seen the weakness in that approach to language, or that narrow approach to language. But it's also a bit more insidious now, because we're also now in danger of losing that referential component, where the very concept of what's true and what's false, or what we can conclude based on evidence versus what we wish were true, but there's no evidence for, that's becoming much more problematic in the early 21st century. So how to balance the need for metaphor and the need for stories and the need for this non-referential language that stirs us so much inside with language that's still grounded in some sort of referential component, so we can still talk about what's true and what's false and what Conclusions are good to draw based on a certain set of evidence, and what conclusions are not good to draw based on a certain set of evidence. I think we've almost gone too far in the other direction, where we've embraced metaphor and what we wish were true so much that we've lost the ability to stay grounded in reality in some ways. And I don't know how that all shakes out, but I think there's been a pendulum swing in our philosophy of language, and you know, we've gone from hyper metaphorical to hyper literal and factual to now we're in this kind of post-truth era where it's not quite metaphorical and poetic. It's not quite grounded in fact anymore.
Right.
It's much more, it's almost like we've lost the best of both worlds. You know, our language today is not as rich and poetic and metaphorical. It's not as grounded in facts, at least right. in the political realm as it used to be. And I find that very problematic, because I think we're losing two really important components of language in the cultural move in that direction.
It's very difficult. Let me ask you, Zachary, have you ever dropped a Star Trek reference in a conversation and the person had no idea what you were talking about?
All the time. And what I'm constantly surprised about is I'm surprised at the people that I would think would be Star Trek fans that are intelligent and insightful and culturally aware and moved by what humans could be in the best version of ourselves, and they just aren't Star Trek fans. It just doesn't work for them. And I'm constantly kind of making bad choices in this regard, like assuming people are going to be Star Trek fans based on all of those other things about them. And a lot of the time, I'm just wrong. They're not Star Trek fans, and they don't get the reference. And, you know, they know I'm a Star Trek fan, and they know I do a Star Trek podcast, and it doesn't cause any issues, but sure, absolutely, all the time. But are you describing the kind of miscommunication that happens inside this episode? Like, this alien captain drops a reference that Captain Picard doesn't get.
Exactly. That's exactly what's going on in this episode. It's not that they don't understand the words. They don't know what the words mean. So Data says inside the episode, he said, our situation is analogous to knowing the grammar of a language, but none of the vocabulary. So basically they're dropping all these references to this, and we don't know if it actually happened or if it's something from a storybook or what. But basically what's going on here is they're dropping language from, for instance, the Bible or a classical piece of literature or a blockbuster movie. We don't know.
Well, inside the episode, Counselor Troy uses the Romeo and Juliet reference. Juliet on her balcony is meaningful to us yes. culturally. But there's two components to that. There's the grammar, yes, arranging the words in the right way. That's literally what grammar is, right? Then there's the denotative element. What do the words literally refer to? Juliet refers to this person named Juliet. Romeo refers to this person named Romeo. The balcony refers to this thing we call a balcony up there, 10 feet up or whatever. But that's not all there is to language either. It's not just a matter of knowing the reference. It's a matter of knowing the meaningfulness, the connotations, not just the denotations of the language. The connotation of Juliet on her balcony is a romantic connotation. That has nothing to do with the denotative element, right? The denotative element doesn't tell you anything at all about the meaningfulness of the situation. Juliet on her balcony, if you look at it purely denotatively, just says Juliet, this person, on her balcony up there in that thing, right? That doesn't give you any romantic connotations. I think the important lesson there is that it's not even just a matter of understanding the vocabulary. Data's point is that, well, if we just understood the vocabulary a little better, we would understand the meaningfulness. I don't think that's even true, because meaningfulness is more a matter of connotation than of denotation and a vocabulary lesson.
I can say to you, you can ask me, hey, Mike, how's your day going? And I can say to you, Zachary, my warp core is getting ready to breach. You know I'm having a bad day.
I think we should strive to do this over the next few episodes of Metatrex. When we ask each other how our day is going, we should strive to give it metaphorically, at least for a few episodes. A little trial
but
run.
But I know that everyone listening to this show, given the assumption that everyone listening to our show are Star Trek fans, and I realize that some people listen to our show because, it's more the philosophy conversation, but let's just assume for the moment that everyone listening to our show, they're Star Trek fans, and they've experienced this before. They've dropped a Star Trek reference, and the person they're talking to has no idea. I could be talking, for instance, to a group of young people, and I could say, Lucy, I'm home. They have no idea what I'm talking about. You're killing me, Smalls. You think about all of these kind of references that we have
from movies. I don't know. You're killing me, Smalls. Are
you shaking your head? You don't. Oh my gosh.
Am I supposed to know that? Yeah, you're a few years older than I am. I probably missed that one.
Zachary, that's your homework assignment. Google "You're Killing Me, Smalls," killing and then Smalls. Go watch okay. and then go watch the movie. That's your homework assignment.
You must be old, Mike.
That's a great movie, by the way. So you heard it here. I stumped Zachary. But my point is this. The beauty of metaphor
Hold on, wait, stop you. See, what you don't realize, Mike, is that almost every conversation I've had with my coworkers and some friend groups involve something very much like this. Let's all talk about another movie Zach hasn't seen.
All right.
So you're in good company.
Well, I've given you a homework assignment, so hopefully next time when we record Metatrex 85...
My old Applia coworkers are right now going, we've been there.
You're killing me, Smalls, in a sentence. The danger of metaphor is that we lose the ability to communicate if the person on the receiving end doesn't understand the nature of the metaphor. So you have to go in and you have to explain and so inside this episode that's the problem. The Federation, Captain Picard in this case, they don't understand the nature of the metaphor, so they're unable to grasp what's being said, even though they understand the words.
Do you think that kind of cross-cultural understanding is ever truly possible? As I think about Data trying to analyze this language, even something as simple that we'd understand, like Juliet on her balcony. I like that that's used inside the episode because it gives us a nice concrete example we all understand to talk about.
And calling back to our last episode of Metatrex, there's another great Shakespearean reference inside Star Trek.
Yes.
I had to throw that in there.
It is interesting how much Shakespeare has been sprinkled throughout Star Trek, absolutely. And I'm not a Shakespeare scholar by any stretch of the imagination, so I find it interesting. But
me neither.
You know, if you get a Shakespeare scholar in here, they could talk all about that. But as I put myself in Data's shoes, trying to analyze something even as simple that we understand as Juliet on her balcony, I worry that Data will never be able to understand the connotation of that. He can think about it syntactically. He can think about it denotatively. He could even kind of analyze the connotation. He could probably recite back to you that, oh, Juliet on her balcony means something romantic. He could probably get that far. But whether he really truly understands the connotation of that and the emotional meaningfulness of that situation, that piece of language, that metaphor, I question whether that's true. I don't think Data has the experience or the ability to transcend, you know, the gap from where he's at to what that example means to humans. And I think the same is true of other examples that we use. I recently reread Homer's Odyssey, and you could drop a reference like Odysseus on his boat. that conveys so much meaningfulness, this longing to be home and a journey and war and all of these connotations that are not just a matter of understanding the references. It's a matter of feeling the emotional connotations of that example, right? Having been lost, having trying to get home, having to go fight a war, whatever it is, it's a very multi-layered tapestry of meaningfulness in these metaphors. So one question I think is whether someone like Data can ever understand the connotations based solely on vocabulary and solely on denotation, and even understanding the history and understanding the literature. Mm-hmm. Now, by extension, looking at Captain Picard and this alien captain, is Captain Picard ever able to transcend that cultural gap and be able to understand the richness of the metaphors that this alien captain is using, even if he learns the history, even if he compares it to his own emotional experience, even as they learn to communicate? Do they ever communicate in a true one-to-one, fully fledged understanding kind of sense in the way that you and I understand Juliet on her balcony?
I think it's difficult to answer, but I will say that this kind of really beautiful breakthrough moment, and let me just interject right there and say that in a lot of ways for Star Trek fans, some of the dialogue from this episode has become some of that metaphoric language that we Star Trek fans like to use.
Are you saying it's meta-metaphoric?
It's meta-metaphoric. That's awesome. Meta-metaphoric. I like it. This beautiful kind of breakthrough moment as the alien captain is dying, Captain Picard begins to recite the Epic of Gilgamesh. And it's this really great moment where you feel like they really understand one another. Picard has grasped this idea that this captain is speaking to him in metaphor. And Captain Picard then begins to share one of our great metaphors here in humanity. And unfortunately, it's one I think that is certainly a dying metaphor these days.
You'd be hard-pressed to find someone who's read it.
Yeah, and that's a shame, quite frankly. That's my opinion. I'll get hate mail over that, but that's a shame because the Epic of Gilgamesh, I think, is classic reading. Here's a homework assignment for our listeners. If you haven't read the Epic of Gilgamesh, you should go read it. I think, one of the greatest little pieces of classic literature that we have. And it tells an incredible story. I think that's important. But this is this great breakthrough moment where they exchange metaphor a little bit. And I think it says something, Zachary, that I believe is really important for our own society. And in our own culture, each culture has their own metaphors. We all have these stories that are meaningful to us. They're part of our history, whether we realize it or not. These stories are part of who we are and they're part of our history. And oftentimes, the metaphor that we kind of dip into, that we think through, that we communicate with, I think says a great deal about us. And I think one of the ways that we can learn as a society to communicate effectively with one another is to really understand the stories of other cultures, of other nations, of other peoples. Because when we begin to understand the metaphors that are important to other cultures, we begin to understand the culture. And I think that's still true today, regardless of what is happening in our world with, you know, metaphor kind of dying in many ways. I think it really becomes the key to understanding one another in a deeper, richer sense.
What you're describing to me sounds a lot like a cultural translation process. And if there's one aspect of this episode that I'm a little critical of, it's that I think it's a little overly simplistic in the ability to translate one metaphor into another across cultures. Like, the alien captain has the Darmok and Jalata Tanagra metaphor, and Captain Picard uses mm-hmm. the Gilgamesh metaphor. And there's kind of this aha moment, like, oh, this story is very similar to this story, and they seem to instantly understand the similarity between these stories. I just wonder if that's a little overly simplistic. You know, what if Darmok and Jalata Tanagra had a bunch of connotations, being afraid or being overwhelmed or being in danger? And what if Gilgamesh had a slightly different set of connotations? Even if the stories sound sort of structurally similar, that doesn't mean that the connotation of the stories and the meaningfulness of the stories is similar. So I kind of view it, you know, I like talking about Venn diagrams, but I kind of view it like a Venn diagram. You've got a story and a metaphor in one circle, and another culture's story and metaphor in another circle, and they're going to overlap to some degree. Like, there'll be some structural mm-hmm. similarity, there'll be some similar experiences, some similar emotions, but I don't think it's ever going to be a perfect one-to-one correspondence. It's still going to be a matter of trying to understand what that metaphor means, not to you as the outsider listening to the metaphor, but what does it mean to the culture to whom that metaphor belongs. And I think that's much harder to understand than the simple one-to-one sense that we seem to get inside this episode.
Well, that's interesting, you know, and that's probably the most common metaphor inside this episode, Darmok and Jalata Tanagra. So that's a metaphor that conveys the idea of fighting a common enemy. But in order to understand what that means, you have to understand the larger story, right? You have to understand Darmok and Jalad were two individuals who had a common enemy, but they could have easily been brothers. that were long lost brothers that came together and found one another at this place called Tanagra. They could have been lovers, and Tanagra is, you know, this place where, you know, they fell in love. I don't know. It could convey a lot of things, but it is a metaphor for fighting a common enemy. But in order to understand that, you have to understand the story. And that's what makes metaphor difficult.
I guess that's fundamentally my point, that if you take the entire set of stories about fighting a common enemy, you know, whether it's a story from World War II, or whether it's Darmok and Jalata Tanagra, or whether it's Gilgamesh, or whatever it is, right? Do those different stories from different cultures and different time periods have more in common because they're all about fighting the same enemy, and there's something transcultural and universal in that diversity of metaphors and diversity of stories? Or when you dig down into those stories and look at the connotations and the details and the backstories and the meaningfulness of those stories to their individual cultures, does the similarity, the quasi-universality that seems to make these metaphors intelligible across cultures, does that fall apart when you really dig down into the details and realize that the connotations of these different stories and the details are all so very different from one another?
Yeah, that's a great point. I just know in my own life, I really make a conscious effort to get them to tell me their story. I learn so much when people just tell me their story. So I am very intentional about asking questions in order to get them to tell me their story. Where are they from? You know, who they are, where they work, you know, what their passions are. And so
here's a story of a man named Brady.
And unfortunately, Zachary, unfortunately, there are people out there that just, who are listening to this, that aren't going to get it. They're not going to understand what you just referred to. And I just say to you, go Google it and figure it out. If Zach just dropped a metaphor that you don't understand, go Google that and find out, because it really becomes the key, I think, in a lot of ways to understanding. I think,
so rather than Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra, we have Mike and Carol Brady in the kitchen.
Alice in the backyard.
Whoa, what is Alice doing in the backyard this week?
Oh, well, Zachary, we have
completely lost our younger listeners. See, we just had a Darmok moment.
Well, Zachary, what's your next pick?
So my next pick is Eyeborg.
Wow.
Was that one of your picks? Why did you say wow? Oh,
absolutely.
If you remember, Eyeborg is the episode where we have a lone Borg that's been disconnected from the hive mind that discovers for the first time his individuality, and Captain Picard has to face the difficult choice of using this Borg, which they name Hugh, as a weapon, sending him back to the Borg with a virus that's going to not only kill Hugh eventually, but also destroy all of the Borg eventually. Total system failure for the Borg. Essentially genocide against an entire race, if you can call the Borg a race of beings. And this episode is interesting to me for a number of reasons. One is, of course, just the obvious issue of genocide. Like, what are the rules of war if the Borg has essentially declared war on the Federation? Is the Federation justified in taking the extreme measure of not just winning the war, but killing all of the Borg for the sake of their own self-preservation? I think that itself is an interesting issue about the rules in a just war, so to speak. But the reason I put this episode on my list has more to do with Hugh himself and what Captain Picard and company's responsibility is to Hugh. I think before Hugh discovers his humanity, before he becomes an individual, you could plausibly say that there is no individual there to be harmed. It's not a person. It's a Borg. It's a drone. So loading Hugh up with a virus and sending him back to the Borg, you haven't harmed anyone in particular, because there are no individuals. There aren't people per se. To put a Kantian spin on it, there isn't a rational agent there that's worthy of any respect as a fellow rational being, right? It's more like a machine and less like a human. But as Hugh discovers his individuality, he becomes an equal in some regard. He has self-awareness, he has intentions, he is able to reason. In a nascent kind of way, he's learning those skills, but he's more self-aware than machine-like at a certain point in the episode. It's not exactly clear when that transition takes place. It's kind of a very quick, gradual transition. But at a certain point, he becomes a self-aware, rational being worthy of moral respect in the Kantian sense. And it's that Captain Picard has to wrestle with. He has to decide to use this intelligent being, Hugh, essentially as a tool to accomplish his own ends. He has to load him up with a virus and send him back to the Borg, use him as a means to achieve victory over the Borg, what's essentially genocide of the Borg, but let's call it victory over the Borg to tone it down just a notch. And he, I think Captain Picard is wrestling with that Kantian question. Is this being, Hugh, worthy of respect as an individual, or can I treat him like a machine, treat him like a tool to be used to accomplish a certain goal?
Yeah, I agree completely. And I'm glad you were thinking in that vein, because frankly, this was on my list. This is actually my third pick on my list. And the thing that I struggled with in putting it on my list was, is it so obvious within the episode to justify really putting this particular episode above so many other worthy episodes? I was really gravitating towards this idea, this struggle of certainly we're dealing with collectivism versus individuality. That's kind of low hanging fruit of this episode, right? So beyond that, it is this concept of, you know, okay, we're just going to take this random, nameless, almost faceless Borg. We're going to load him up with a virus. We're going to send him back to the Borg. We're going to annihilate the Borg, and, you know, we win. But as he asserts his individualism, now we're hurting a person. And we deal with this in warfare to some degree, right? I mean, it's one thing to say in a very Klingon way, death to the enemy. It's a whole other thing for me to say, you know, death to, and then start naming names. A terror attack or a war, whatever the case may be, it takes on a whole different connotation when, you know, it's not five victims, but now we're naming five people. Those were five sons, five daughters, whatever the case may be. You know, if you three men, three women. So that's, you know, that's three husbands, three brothers, three sons, you know,
a couple of Brady Bunches,
It becomes something else. Very personal, very individual that I think is quite a bit more uncomfortable than just saying five victims.
Well, I think the end game of this episode was determined the second Geordi named Hugh.
Yes, right? I agree.
Because you're right. For we humans, when we've named something, we kind of attach an emotional connection to it. But that's not Kant's point. That, you know, someone with a name is worthy of respect, right? Kant's point was that self-awareness and being a rational agent is what makes you worthy of moral respect. And at a certain point, that whether Hugh has a name, even if they didn't name him in the episode, this would be true, right? That at a certain point, Hugh becomes self-aware. And if you remember, one of Kant's fundamental moral principles was called the categorical imperative. And one formulation of that categorical imperative was that it's immoral to treat other rational agents as merely as a means to accomplish your own ends. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going on in this episode, right? Hugh, who may or may not be self-aware, and he is at a certain point, but they are going to use Hugh as a tool. It's not just a matter of giving him a name and being emotionally attached to him. It's whether it is morally acceptable to take another self-aware being and to use that being sort of against their will to accomplish your own ends. And at a certain point, Hugh, I think, meets the criterion for self-awareness, and Captain Picard rightly recognized that it's immoral to use Hugh, a fellow self-aware being, in this way.
As I said, I'm just really glad that you took that approach with it as well, because I was just concerned I was reaching a little bit. This is one of those episodes that, again, the low-hanging fruit there is collectivism versus individuality, and it's really easy to just say, oh, that's what this is about, and move on. And I was looking at it in a much deeper way, and I was just afraid that my intuitions were kind of going off into left field, but I'm relieved that you at least see it in a similar way that I do.
No, but I do want to say that I don't think that the Borg necessarily connote the difference between individualism and collectivism in some senses, right? Because we're talking about the difference between being self-aware or not being self-aware. And collectivism doesn't necessarily connote a lack of self-awareness. It connotes very wonderful things like working together to solve problems. And mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't mean the mindless, faceless anonymity of being a right. Borg drone. So I don't think that because we have a Borg episode, it automatically makes it an episode about individualism versus collectivism in a great many senses.
Right, right. So I Borg, it's on my list as well. Zachary, I'm going to go with my next pick, and I don't have a great deal to say about it because we have talked about this in depth in a previous edition of Metatrex. That episode is Cause and Effect. Cause and Effect. We talked about this, Zachary, as you may recall, in episode 33 entitled All Threes. So go back into the back catalog to episode 33. All Threes is the name of that episode. Zachary and I talk about the metaphysics of time and cause and effect in great, great depth.
I figured when we did episode 33, that was the one and only time we would get synchronicity between the episode number and the topic of the episode. So we had to do Cause and Effect in episode 33. I guess if we do 333 episodes of Metatrex someday, maybe we can revisit it.
I think that would be great.
All Threes, part three.
But I'm not going to say much more about this episode, Cause and Effect. It really does deal with the metaphysics of time. That certainly, I think, is the main theme of it. And I think our discussion, and I went back and I listened to it this past week, the discussion that we had all the way back at episode 33 from 4th of July, 2016. And I really don't have anything more to say about this episode, Cause and Effect, that we didn't cover in All Threes, episode 33 of Metatrex. So that's, as Forrest Gump would say, that's all I have to say about that.
Well, you have a fundamental problem when it comes to telling anything resembling a time travel story, whether time travel in the Back to the Future sense or other things you can do with time. And I think this episode for me falls into the other interesting things you can do with time besides traditional time travel Back to the Future stories, right? You know, time travel is well-trodden territory in Star Trek at this point. So if you're going to tell a time travel story, you have to do it in a different way. And that's exactly the situation that they were facing for Cause and Effect. You know, we wanted to do something about time, but couldn't just do Back to the Future, couldn't do, you know, go save the whales in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. It had to be different. So a causal loop was a very interesting way to approach a quasi-time travel story in a novel way. And it does let you explore the metaphysics of time in a metaphorical kind of way through story and through the mechanics of how time works inside the Star Trek universe. So I don't have a lot to say about it either, but I think it's to be commended for coming up with a novel way to explore the concept of time in a way that hadn't been done before.
Yeah, I had gone into great depth in explaining Cause and Effect to a friend of mine who is not a Star Trek fan. And the response that I got was, oh, yeah, that sounds a lot like Groundhog Day. So I guess this is the Groundhog Day of Star Trek.
Except that Groundhog Day doesn't seem to be grounded in any kind of science, right? It's just there's this weird reset button in Groundhog Day that just happens, and there's no real explanation for it. Here, at least, we get some, you know, pseudo-scientific, Star Trek-y, you know, supposedly grounded in science kind of explanation for why this time jumping and causal loop seems to be happening. But Groundhog Day is more like fantasy, and Star Trek even if it's all fictional, tries to stay grounded in some sort of actual science, at least tries to give a scientific explanation, even a futuristic, you know, fictional scientific explanation for what's going on.
Zachary, are you saying that small rodents can't predict the weather?
Blasphemy. Pure fiction.
So was cause and effect on your list, Zachary?
It was not, actually.
Oh,
partly because I just don't think there's enough there. It's an interesting, for me.
What do you mean? We hour and 42 minutes we talked about it.
See, okay, but this is an example of how things change over time. Like right now, I don't find that episode particularly philosophically interesting. I'm like, yeah, so there's a time loop. So what? What do we learn about time from that? Nothing. Not to undercut everything we said in episode 33 of Metatrex, but honestly, no, as I think about it now, I don't find it as interesting. I find it an interesting story, and I find the concept of what they do with time interesting, obviously. But what can I learn philosophically about time from that episode? Not as much as I did 50 episodes ago, I guess. I'll have to go back and listen to it. I'm sure we said something good about it.
Cause and effect is rubbish.
I can barely remember what we talked about last episode, much less 50 episodes ago.
An hour and 42 minutes of conversation in episode 33 of Metatrex, all rubbish. Just strike it from the record and move on.
I don't mean to be so... No, it's a great episode. I don't mean to be so harsh about it. I just didn't find it interesting this time around, so...
You're breaking my heart, man.
It's a great episode. I'm not saying it's a bad episode. It's one of my favorite episodes. I just I find that less interesting than I find talking about referential language in Darmok, and less interesting than talking about Kantian respect for sentient beings in Iborg.
Okay. So Zachary, by my count, you have given three picks. And we've matched on a lot of these. So of the six that I had, the three main picks, the three honorable mentions, four of my picks have come out. So you still have two more. I still have two more. Both of mine at this point are honorable mentions because my main picks, Darmok, Cause and Effect, Iborg, those were my three main picks. We've already mentioned Masterpiece Society. That is one of my honorable mentions. I've got two honorable mentions left. What do you have?
So my first honorable mention is A Matter of Time, speaking of time travel.
Okay. Well, lightning round these.
I don't have a lot to say about A Matter of Time. If you remember, this is the episode where a seemingly futuristic professor travels backward in time to visit the Enterprise D. And we find out in the course of the episode that it's actually a person from the past, an inventor from, I think it was the 22nd century, who travels forward in time with this stolen time travel shuttlecraft thing, which is really cool looking on the inside, by the way. It's one of the coolest things in Star Trek, that cool little rainbow sheen metallic interior that it's got. I want that for my wallpaper. That's great stuff. What I love about this episode is that it raises the question, to me, of a Good Samaritan rule. Is there an obligation to help beings that you have the ability to help? So in the episode, there's this planet that's going to face ruin from the asteroid of the week, which seems to be a trope in The Next Generation. Right, this week, this planet is in danger from this phenomenon, and so we have to save this group of people. So there's one of those Next Generation situations, which we all love, but, you know, you can only do so many times. And this time-traveling professor presumably knows what's going to happen. If he were really from the future, he would know what's going to happen. But he has the records from the future time ship machine, and he seems to know what's going to happen. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he doesn't really know what's going to happen, and it's all an act. I never really considered that possibility until right now. I assumed that he actually did know the outcome, even though he was from the past, because of the futuristic time ship that he's using in. Would have some historical records, which is how he knew to find Captain Picard in the first place.
I get the impression he's winging it, but that's just...
Yeah, I'm not really sure. But let's assume that he knows the outcome of the situation. Does he have an obligation to render aid to the people on this planet whose lives are in danger that he has the ability to affect the outcome for? He takes the position of saying, it's not my problem. You know, your future is my past, so I don't need to worry about it. I don't need to care. And there's a genuine question in our world about Good Samaritan laws. You know, if you're passing by someone getting beat up, or you're passing by someone where there's an altercation, or you're passing by someone who needs assistance, do you have a moral and legal obligation to render aid? Or is it perfectly admissible Or is it perfectly morally acceptable to say, this is not my situation, I'm not involved, and I don't have an obligation? Are you blameworthy for taking that approach and not getting involved, or do you have a moral obligation? So it's a bit of a stretch, I think, to draw the connection between a Good Samaritan law and the situation in this episode. But clearly, Professor Rasmussen inside this episode is taking the latter approach of saying, this is not my situation, this is not my world, not my century, so I'm going to stand back and watch Captain Picard struggle and figure it out. Is that an acceptable approach, especially given things like the temporal prime directive that we learned about later in Star Trek? Or does he have a moral obligation to save as many people as he can purely because he's there and he has the ability and the power to?
And I think Kant would say, yes, he does.
I think Kant would, because he would say that's a universalizable principle, right? Rendering aid when you can is something that doesn't create any logical contradictions, and it's universalizable. I think purely on a utilitarian perspective, right? Trying to minimize harm and maximize a good outcome for the greatest number of people. And clearly trying to save people passes the utilitarian test pretty easily, unless you're creating future harm. If saving a bunch of people on this planet damages future centuries, a greater number of people in future centuries, that's an interesting kind of utilitarian question. How do you weigh a certain number of people in the present versus the outcome for a certain number of people in the future that don't exist yet? And what's the relationship between those two groups of people from a utilitarian standpoint? I don't think that's totally clear either, but I think plausibly you can say, look, if you can save a bunch of people, that maximizes utility, so it's the right thing to do. So on almost any moral theory, it seems like the right thing to do is to help, but yet we don't hold people accountable for standing back and not getting involved in situations that aren't their business generally.
I will say that the Rasmussen character was actually written for Robin Williams, who was a Star Trek fan in his own right, and of course good friend Whoopi Goldberg had appealed to have an episode, a character written for him. And so the character Rasmussen was actually written with him in mind, and he wasn't able to hold to the agreement to film the episode. And so it fell to Matt Frewer, a.k.a. Max Headroom. I like Matt Frewer. I think he did a good job in this episode, but I have to say that I would have loved to have seen this character done as it was written channeled through Robin Williams. I think would have brought a whole other level of interesting to it. I find this episode just a little bit on the dull side, just because Matt Frewer's characters are a little on the dull side, and that's his appeal. So Zachary, I have an honorable mention, and it is Conundrum. Conundrum, of course, is that episode where this strange beam scans the Enterprise as they're en route to lend aid and renders everybody on the ship unable to remember who they are.
Not the one where Captain Picard gets a flute.
No flutes.
A different strange beam from a different space thing.
No flutes. Okay. No flutes. This is the Riker-Rolaren hookup episode for those out there keeping score.
Literally, I guess. Riker,
literally. this is a really interesting episode because in an instant, everyone can remember their, you know, basically the essence of their jobs. Dr. Crusher remembers how to be a doctor. Rolaren can remember how to fly the ship. But no one really knows who they are. They don't know what their rank is. And they get bamboozled a little bit. They get pulled into a worse situation that they were never supposed to be pulled into. And with their memories gone and their lack of clarity as to what their mission is, it was easy for them to get pulled into it. And it's interesting kind of to see these characters sort of trying to figure it out. Worf asserting himself as commanding officer. This is he's the captain. He's sitting in the chair. He's giving orders. He's getting status reports.
I like Captain Picard's, Worf.
Picard a little uneasy with the idea of asserting his opinion and giving his opinion. He's a little unsure of himself as he's doing that. And so I find that aspect of this very interesting, this idea of identity. And so that really appeals. Is it enough to go on my main list? No, but there's enough there that I think I just had to put it on my honorable mention list.
I think it's a great episode to talk about personal identity, because one common theory of personal identity is that our self-identity, our personal identity, is a matter of the steady stream and continuation of our memories and experiences in a cumulative kind of way. And if there's a radical discontinuity of memory, if, you know, this is like collective amnesia, where everyone has forgotten who they are and a great many of their experiences, they essentially develop new personalities because they can't rely on any of their past experiences that they don't remember. There's certainly some innate personality traits that come to the forefront. But the things that make
Jordy remembers how to use a PowerPoint. That's always a good thing.
Is there a Jordy PowerPoint in the episode?
There is a Jordy PowerPoint. He can't remember who he is, but he knows how to do a Jordy PowerPoint.
Once you've got PowerPoint skills, you never lose it. But in this case, no one on the ship can make use of all of their past experience to guide their sense of identity. So they essentially have to, on the fly, develop new personalities.
And I find that really appealing. I don't think there's enough there, again, to put it up with something like Iborg or Darmok, but certainly I think it's worthy of mentioning as an honorable mention. Zachary, you have another honorable mention?
I do, but I almost hesitated to put this on my list. It seems odd not to put this on the list, given the title of the episode. And the title of the episode is Ethics. So
that's my last honorable mention as well.
So why on earth would I choose not to put an episode named Ethics on my list of top philosophical episodes in season 5 of Star Trek: The Next Generation? And I think it's for the same reason that I didn't put Cause and Effect on my list. I think there's just quite not enough there, as interesting of a dilemma as we've got in the episode. And if you remember, this episode is the episode where Worf gets hit on the back with a container that fell on him in a cargo bay. His back is broken. He's going to be a quadriplegic his entire life. And in this episode, there's a visiting doctor, Dr. Russell, who takes some liberties with medical ethics, being willing to try experimental treatments, even if it means risking the lives of her patients, because those treatments haven't gone through the rigor of testing and scientific analysis that justifies their use in the everyday medical setting. But one of her experimental treatments has the ability to basically repair Worf's back, replicate him a new spine, that they're going to take out his spine and put in a new spine, which I find that in itself I find really fascinating, because it's the kind of thing that sounds more plausible now than it did 30 years ago. So, you know, the future is marching on for sure. We're not quite at the stage of replicating organs, but we can genetically engineer, or we're closer to genetically engineering organs than we were 30 years ago. So it's not outside the realm of possibility that we'll have something similar to that someday. But as I think through the issues in the episode, there are the strictly speaking medical ethics. What does it take for a procedure to go through to be fully vetted for use in a medical setting in an official kind of way? What kind of testing? What kind of approvals? Presumably the Federation has some sort of approvals, just like we do. Here in the real world, we have FDA approval of things, whether they're medicines or medical procedures, whatnot, right? Presumably the Federation has something similar. There's some sort of review board that looks at all the evidence and does their own testing. And after some sort of very lengthy process, a certain medical procedure is stamped for approval, ready for use out there in the real world, deemed safe, deemed whatever. And this doctor, Dr. Russell, seems willing to circumvent that process, taking risks with the lives of her patients. Sometimes those risks pan out, but once in a while they don't, and she loses a patient inside the episode that a conventional treatment would have saved. So I like the episode because it raises this strictly speaking medical ethics question. What does it take for a medical procedure or a treatment to be safe for general use? I don't know much about that. I'm not a doctor. You're a little more familiar with the medical field than I am, so you probably have more to say about that than I do. But it does seem to raise an ethical question that we can talk about in a philosophical sense. One is this kind of Kantian approach, like what are the rules involved in the approval of medical treatments, right? There is a process and there are rules, and when a procedure has gone through all those rules and all those processes, then it's stamped for approval. But Dr. Russell takes a very consequentialist approach that she knows she's taking a gamble. Most of the time that gamble pays off, and she ends up saving a life, or, you know, bettering someone's life that may not be saved or may not be bettered otherwise. Once in a while, she loses the gamble and she loses a patient. But I think she could plausibly say from a utilitarian standpoint that if her gambles pay off, then they were the right thing to do.
Yeah, and I think the disturbing thing inside this episode is she's quite willing to do that.
Well, she does it kind of flippantly. She doesn't... It's one thing to sit down and reflect on the gamble and think, okay, this is really a gamble. I might lose this patient. I might save this patient. It makes it worse that if a conventional treatment would save someone's life and they choose not to use that conventional treatment, that makes it doubly worse, I think. But as I picture, okay, say you don't know how to save someone's life and you have an experimental treatment. It's a gamble, right? It may work and it may not. And sure. If it's a situation where the patient's going to die anyway, you might as well take the gamble. So taking a risk on an experimental treatment in that kind of situation doesn't sound morally problematic. But when a conventional treatment would save someone's life and you choose to ignore that fact and go with an experimental treatment that might sacrifice someone's life, that sounds 10 times worse than taking a gamble in a case where you're going to lose the patient anyway.
So Dr. Crusher obviously has some issues with the ethics that are involved in Dr. Russell's practice. And there are a lot of questions raised within the episode, and Dr. Crusher makes her feelings known, so much so that she, at least for a time, suspends Dr. Russell's privileges while she's on the Enterprise. Let me ask you this, Zachary. Do you suppose that some of Dr. Crusher's reasoning, some of her methodology in coming to that decision has more to do with her own sense of medical ethics, or is it her personal connection to the patient?
In the case of Worf?
Yes.
I don't know. For Dr. Crusher, the case had been building against Dr. Russell for a while. She'd already lost a patient from an experimental treatment in a different setting, in a triage setting. And with Worf, of course, she has a special connection to Worf because they're friends and they're part of the same crew and whatnot. And I think that makes it worse in her mind. But I think the damage in Dr. Crusher's mind had already been done from the moment she lost a patient that could have been saved with a conventional treatment. I don't think the connection to Worf has any special bearing there. I think this is the icing on the cake of a bad situation that had already been brewing.
I agree completely. And the heart of the Hippocratic Oath is, and we all know, do no harm. And so Dr. Russell's approach to medicine is something that seems rather removed from that idea. Certainly, you know, certainly her hope is that she's going to be able to transcend to some degree the current ability of medicine to heal the patient in using these experimental treatments. However, the dark underbelly of that is she may, at best, not affect the patient's outcome at all, or at worst, she may actually harm the patient with these experimental medical treatments. And so I think that's at the heart of this episode, and it certainly has a great deal to do with why I had to include it on my honorable mentions list. I do have an interest in these kind of medical ethics type episodes. We talk about medical ethics and this episode to a small degree inside of episode 51 in our back catalog, listeners, Dr. Mora's Jello Mold, episode 51. We also talk about this idea of suicide, euthanasia inside of our episode Good Day for Euthanasia, episode 26 of Metatrex, which is another theme inside this episode, Worf's desire to end his own life as a result of the injury that he's received. So there are a couple of really interesting things, I think, going on in this episode, and certainly, again, that's why it's on my honorable mentions list.
And Worf wanting to commit suicide in this ritual suicide that he asked Riker to do creates one of the most, to me, one of the most dramatic scenes in all of Star Trek The Next Generation, when Riker refuses the request for this ritual suicide.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the question you asked a minute ago about Dr. Crusher's relationship to Worf and the bearing that played in her judgment about Dr. Russell. And it occurred to me that Dr. Russell has what I would describe as an excessive degree of clinical detachment, Like, she's forgotten that she's treating actual people. To her, the people are subjects of experimentation to prove or disprove her theories or verify or disprove some of her hypothetical treatments and whatnot. And Dr. Crusher, I think, takes the more emotionally invested, compassionate doctor approach, right? Dr. Crusher is remembering that these are real people with real lives that she needs to care about as a doctor. And I think Dr. Crusher subtextually points out to Dr. Russell that Dr. Russell doesn't actually care about the people she's treating.
Yeah, I agree completely. And it kind of calls back to what we were talking about with the episode I, Borg, early in our conversation. Give somebody a number and you can call them patient XYZ or patient 123. But to actually give that person a name, they suddenly become, again, a husband, a father, in worst case, a friend, you know, a dad, an exceptional officer, a valued member of the crew. And so it does take on a whole other context. But I will say that I agree. I don't think the personal relationship that Dr. Crusher had with Worf in any way affected her judgment. I had to ask that question because that is a common question that gets raised in these situations where the doctor knows the patient and is being an advocate for the patient. That becomes oftentimes a common, well, you're too close to the patient or you're too close to the situation to appreciate, you know, the high level of problem solving that's going into this decision that we're having to make.
I do think one thing is very clear. I think Dr. Russell would absolutely load Hugh up with the virus and send him back to the Borg.
And not lose a minute's sleep over.
Not a one. Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about Borg genocide today, but this isn't the only thing we've been discussing here on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek.fm.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
I should have had my mom buy me everything because now it would be worth a ton, like the goofy Spock helmet. But I remember hooting at those things back in the day. You know, like, they think we're just stupid. That wasn't in the show. You don't have a real phaser, wouldn't say Star Trek on the side of it.
Standard orbit.
I cannot find anybody in print saying,
we're going to the Standard Enterprise Delta to honor the Enterprise as being the first ship of the constellation, you know, the first of the 5-year mission ships to come back relatively intact with its crew and ship intact.
And it was not some fan did not just say this. Somebody in the production somewhere, and someday, by God, I will find where this came from, because like we didn't all have this mass group hallucination about it. Somebody felt the need to say, everybody's wearing an Enterprise patch now, so, you know, that's past us.
To the journey!
So if we're going to have a more Vulcan-like Tom in Tuvom, presumably Tuvom would have to meditate, and he would have to go somewhere to meditate. I'm thinking he wouldn't just go to his quarters to meditate with candles like Tuvok does, or he wouldn't go sit on some rocks on a planet somewhere. He would go in the holodeck and lock himself in his Camaro and meditate with the radio on.
What would be playing on the radio?
Vulcan opera.
Ah! That sounds horrible.
Warp 5.
Shows the gestation of the Borg from their first cube and the diamond ships. Just transwarp conduits.
Floating on the ocean. Little Borg spacemen.
Yep.
Before they were fully immune to the outside elements, so they had little space helmets, Borg space helmets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we would love to hear your thoughts on today's episode of Metatrex, and there are many ways for you to share your thoughts with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select MetaTreks. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Mike, when you're not giving a poetic reading of the Epic of Gilgamesh, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can catch me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. I'm always glad to talk Star Trek and philosophy in the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. If you follow me, let me know so I'll follow you back. On Instagram, I'm also cmichael1701. You can always catch my blog. That is cmichael1701.wordpress.com. Well, Zachary, when you're not dreaming about life outside your biosphere, where can our listeners find you on Trek FM and around the interwebs?
Just build a bigger biosphere. Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM show dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me in there. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. Well, Mike, before we wrap up the show, would you like to give a recap of our top picks for essential Trek philosophy from Star Trek The Next Generation Season 5?
Certainly, Zachary, it is quite a list. We have the Masterpiece Society, Darmok, Iborg, Cause and Effect, Honorable Mentions, A Matter of Time, Conundrum, and Ethics. That, listeners, is Essential Trek Philosophy from Star Trek The Next Generation Season 5.
And what a great season of Star Trek it is. One of the best in all of Star Trek.
For sure.
Even despite how critical I was of some of your favorite episodes. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, we invite you to become a patron of the network through Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these podcasts each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We would like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And a special thank you and a shout out to our four associate producers here on MetaTreks. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, you can find her under the Twitter handle at ChocoWeeble. Norman Lau at Starfighter1701, and Mark Walker from Parts Unknown. Like the Ultimate Warrior from the WWF, from Parts Unknown.
A Masterpiece Society all their own.
Yes. Collectively, these individuals constitute our very own Masterpiece Society.
Indeed they do.
Well, Mike, as we wrap up the show, we'd like to once more invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of MetaTreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.